Hello, this is Janet Michael. In addition to hosting The Valley Today each weekday from 12:30 to 1 on the River 953, I also produce podcasts. And I'm excited to introduce you to a new podcast series in partnership with Rappahannock Electric Cooperative called We Are REC. Every week, we'll be releasing a new podcast where we interview different people from REC about a host of different topics. We'll get tips for saving money on your electric bill. We'll talk about renewable energy and the impact it can have in our communities. We'll even get some behind-the-scenes info about what happens when the power goes out in a storm. We're going to talk to linemen, energy advisors, board members, even the CEO. Don't miss out on information about community grants, scholarships, REC-hosted events, and more. Get every single episode as they're released on our website under the podcast tab at theriver953.com, or you can subscribe for free in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or on Spotify, anywhere you listen to a podcast. Just search for We Are REC. We are in the studio today with John Arpey. He is the operations manager for the Western Region of Rappahannock Electric Cooperative. John, we've talked in a past episode about weather's impact on reliability for REC, but I'm kind of curious what you guys do to prepare for that. I mean, we talked about a lot of the impact that weather has and all the different storms and what that can lead to. Do you guys have like a system in place or rules and regulations or policies and guidelines for what you do to prepare for storms and things of that nature?
In a number of ways, we have programs that are intended to help try to sustain our reliability, maintenance programs, if you will. And then we also have our what we call our construction work plan, which are the large upgrades, typically more for overloaded line sections or new growth, where we're going to be extending new facilities or upgrade facilities into an area. But for reliability specifically, we have programs that are meant to either prevent the outages or to help our system recover from an outage quicker. We call that resiliency.
Ah.
So reliability is don't have the outage, and resiliency is when you do have the outage, try to be able to recover as quickly as you can.
Keep it as minimal as possible.
Right.
So you guys have things that you probably do year-round to just prevent outages altogether.
Absolutely. As we mentioned in our last podcast, trees have probably the largest impact. Well, definitely the largest impact to our outages. If you look at the number of outages caused by tree impacts, it dwarfs all other causes significantly. So tree trimming, right-of-way maintenance are a key part of our reliability programs. I know this year we have actually directed some additional funding to address tree trimming a little more vigorously than we have before. And it's in some part because of the number of tree outages and outages in general that we had through 2018.
We talked too briefly in that last podcast about the impact of weather and rain and how it tears at the roots of trees. But the other thing that it does is make the trees grow faster and be more full and be bigger and larger and taller, which I guess also impacts tree trimming from year to year to year.
I'm not an arborist, so I can't speak too intelligently on the subject, but to me, more rain means faster growing, so it would grow into the lines quicker, and hence the quicker treatment in trimming. Second or third to trees are animal contacts. Squirrels, snakes, raccoons causing outages.
I never thought about raccoons. As you were saying, I'm like, okay, I know squirrels, I can get snakes, but raccoons climb power poles?
Yeah.
Well, okay then.
We've had some outages, major outages, where the raccoon got up on the substation transformer and took out a couple of thousand services.
Can you prevent that? I mean, how do you keep those types of wildlife from getting in the way?
We try. Snakes are probably the hardest, but we have special equipment, plastic covers, blocks that we put at points where animals can climb onto our, especially our substations. They can climb up the supports to get to the energized equipment. If you've ever looked in a substation and it looks like there's a bunch of see-through umbrellas, that's the animal guard. To try to, and as a matter of fact, for our membership that's listening, there was an article recently that had a picture of some of those in our REC magazine. Out on the overhead lines that go from home to home, typically it's contact at the overhead transformer that causes an outage. So we have a special cover that goes over the bushing of the transformer and the wire that goes from the transformer up to the energized line. And it is to prevent the animal bridging the gap between the grounded body of the transformer and the energized wire.
And that makes sense. So they can still climb, but they're not going to touch anything that's going to cause a short or an outage.
Right. And we have our pole inspection program where we're looking for aged poles that maybe don't have the strength that normally they would have. We have a contractor that does that for us. That's Osmos. And we inspect basically every pole on a cycle. Not every year. It's a number of years between cycles. But they have poles that have to be replaced within a couple of days that are the really bad poles, or poles that are suspect but strong enough that they can probably withstand a season. So that's one of our big maintenance items. Because of the number of outages that we had in 2018, we're also looking at some of the circuits, some of the areas that took the brunt of the outages and damages, and trying to see what special treatment those areas may have, be it animal guards or maybe additional tree trimming, or there may be sections where the wire has just been broke so many times because of trees that it should be replaced. Things of that nature, maintenance, upkeep, strengthen our system against the winds, the storms, the ice. A lot you can do for trees, but we do what we can to try to keep the trees away from the line as best as possible. We also look at the what we call the high reliability zone, or you'd think of it as the main line of the circuit, from the substation out to the first line of protective devices, typically a few miles out of the station. Incidents or outages that impact that high reliability zone take out the entire circuit.
A lot more places and houses and businesses and things along those lines.
Right. So we pay attention to those areas, especially if they've got some of these problems, you know, tree trimming that we need to get in there and address, animal guards, making sure that the smaller taps are fused so that if a tree falls outside of that reliability zone, it's taking out a fuse with a handful of members rather than, you know, a few thousand members.
That makes sense.
During blue sky days, you know, people have outages, and oftentimes they'll wonder what's going on. And a lot of times it's the animals, or it's impact from storms that may be a few weeks old. The storms weaken the trees. You don't have to look very hard driving up and down the roads in our area, looking off the sides of the roads to see the trees hanging, branches hanging, broken trees. A lot of times the blue sky events, that's the event that's not associated with a storm. A lot of times those are residual impact from a storm, you know, be it a week or two old. The rain we talked about, it weakens the soil.
And that sometimes takes a couple of days for you to be able to kind of understand the impact that it had.
Exactly. The high reliability, that's a recurring program. We look at kind of the circuits that have the worst performance and try to go out and address those reliability zones. Our tree trimming is on a cycle, just like our pole inspections. But we are paying attention to some certain hot spots, if you will, that are being impacted more than we would like, to try to get those trimmed. The ash trees in our areas are falling victim to the ash borer, and so we're proactively going out and trying to identify those ash trees that have died, because those dead trees are danger trees.
Even more dangerous than healthy trees that,
Right. So that's part of our program as well, is going out and getting those ash trees, get those cleared. Our forestry crews are doing a phenomenal job with that.
So you're doing all of this stuff kind of throughout the year, but let's say you come into work one morning and you find out that there is a storm is a coming, and it might not be, it might be, you know, 300 miles away from us at this point, but you guys don't wait for it to be on our doorstep to start putting the plan in place for what you're going to do in the moment. I mean, you're doing this stuff year round to hopefully not have such a large impact when a storm comes. But what happens when there is a storm coming? Do you do things differently?
We do, and it depends on the level of impact that is forecasted. We can go into major storm mode, which is basically an all hands on deck. As I mentioned during our last podcast, everyone is involved from the CEO down to the managers, operations, our member services group. Every department is participating in some way, preparing, getting ready when we see those events coming. I think I said before that we all pretend to be amateur meteorologists, guessing where the weather is going to hit, what impact it's going to have.
You're kind of like the opposite of a storm chaser because you're trying to get to the storm before it even gets to you. So right. I don't know what the opposite of that would be, yeah. But that's kind of what you guys are doing.
We'd like to be storm avoiders if possible, but not always possible. But depending upon the impact that we see the storm having on other utilities as it moves toward us will kind of dictate our initial preparation. If it looks very bad, you know, the ice storms, you can see those coming typically, and we will start staging linemen, crews, where we predict the outages will be. Sometimes Mother Nature fools us.
And then skips and goes around or goes a little higher, a little bit lower.
There was a storm, an ice storm a few months ago that we thought for certain would be in the Culpeper and Western areas and had crews moving that direction. And it kind of skipped over us and hit Spotsylvania County and Louisa. Devastated that area in a pretty tight band. But we already had crews rolling, so it was a pretty quick response. But anybody that you ask, we were confident that we were going to be in Culpeper for the next few days, and we ended up in Spotsylvania County.
So. Wow. And you kind of have like this system. There is a system in place where you put the call out to your linemen. You let them know, hey, this is coming. Go into it. I mean, we joke here when it looks like it's getting bad. You hear the city of Winchester sometimes say snow plan A or snow plan B is in effect, which is, you know, here are what you need to do if you're going to be moving around. You guys probably have the exact same thing.
Very similar. For smaller pop-up storms, storms of smaller impacts, you know, maybe a few hundred outages instead of a few thousand. Our dispatch center out of Fredericksburg will basically run and manage the storm. They'll call the crews. They'll dispatch them to the cases of trouble. As the outages build, as the storm gets worse, some of that operational control will be passed out to the regional offices, local. Mm-hmm. Still calling crews. We'll have computer support from the dispatchers, but it depends on the magnitude of the storm, which program, if you will, we implement. Again, when we see those larger events that are going to impact multiple areas.
Hurricane remnants and things like that right. are heading this way.
That's where we kind of trigger the major event button, if you will. And, you know, it's an all hands on deck. Everybody should be prepared in some way, shape, or form to participate in outage restoration, be it working on a computer to figure out where we can transfer load, to answering the additional member calls that come in, to working with neighboring utilities if we decide that we need mutual aid from a other cooperative, kind of laying the groundwork for that ahead of time. Hey, looks like we're going to be hit pretty hard. The weather predicts that, you know, our Southern Virginia co-ops are going to be in the clear. Rappahannock operates within an association of a number of cooperatives in Virginia, and Maryland and Delaware. And when these storm events are rolling in, the association cooperatives will kind of get together to discuss just this sort of thing, the storm planning. Where does it look like the impact is going to be? How bad does the impact appear to be? And start, if we want to pre-stage mutual aid crews, go ahead and request those ahead of time. We did that during a couple of the winter events late last year and then early this year. Actually called the crews from neighboring cooperatives before the storm got here because we knew based on the pattern of the storm coming in that we were going to get hit. Maybe not where, but we knew we were definitely going to have a large number of outages. And pre-staging our own crews. You know, we've got crews as far away as Bowling Green, down toward Richmond, all the way up to Winchester, and down in Albemarle, just north of Charlottesville. So we've got a pretty good staff of linemen that we can call upon internally for aid as well. And getting them moving when it's safe to do so is important and part of our preparation a lot of times.
Yeah, because the more you can do of that in advance of a storm, obviously the quicker you're going to be able to restore power and make everybody happy again.
Exactly.
Now, is there a lot of cleanup after a storm? I mean, does it all kind of, I assume you have to go back around then and assess, because in some cases, I'm guessing you're putting up some things to get the power back on, thinking, okay, once we're out of this danger, we'll come back and we'll rechange this, or you notice something during a storm that you may not have seen for an inspection for another couple of weeks, maybe.
Yeah, there is some of that occasionally. We won't leave an unsafe condition out there. You know, public safety is as important as our linemen personal safety. But where we can make something safe and restore power without a major replacement or something along those lines, we will. You may brace a pole, kind of like a cast on a pole, to get it operational and safe to carry the line, and then come back out after the storm and get that pole replaced, things of that nature. A lot of the time, the mop-up at the end of the storm are services where the wire is broke from the pole into someone's house. So typically the last day or day and a half of the storm, you may work all day and only restore a handful of consumers, because
it's individual to their homes or their businesses or whatnot.
Right. And the hierarchy that we typically try to address outages leads to that. You know, we typically are trying to look at the largest outages, the substation outages that are affecting thousands or tens of thousands of consumers, and then the pockets of large outages. And also you have in there our concern for emergency services, fire, police, the emergency broadcast system, you know, our radio stations. The emergency broadcast system piggybacks on a lot of our radio station services. So trying to make sure that those are restored as quickly as possible. Hospitals.
Oh, yeah.
So naturally, kind of the triage that you go through when you're restoring leads to those last few days being the mop-up, the services, the single outages, and taking those crews in and going back and making permanent repairs for some of the stuff that was temporarily fixed safely to get power restored as quickly as possible.
And then go home and get some sleep and wait for the next storm to come through.
Then go home and get ready for the next storm. That's right.
Well, and I got to hand it to all of your guys. I know we've mentioned William several times. I mean, the dedication that they have for their jobs. He made, it was just a passing statement at the end of the podcast recording that we did with him a few weeks ago, that he sometimes felt like they were the forgotten first responders. And that really struck a nerve with me. That's what I named that podcast episode, because it really is true.
One of the hierarchy I mentioned, I mentioned the facilities, the police, the fire, but also we call them 911 calls. It's the wire down across the road. Mm-hmm. Or things of that nature, where the fire department, police department, rescue squad, we don't want them handling the wire, because we can't verify that it's de-energized until we take certain steps and precautions. So we're very often among the first responders where highway and wires down are involved. Sometimes the fire department beats us, sometimes we beat them, but it's very true that our guys are our first responders in every sense of the word.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, we talk about first responders. You mentioned hospitals, too. I do a lot of interviews with people from Valley Health, which is our major health network here. And we always joke a lot of times about how a lot of their job, so to speak, is to put themselves out of business, because they understand that preventing somebody from becoming ill or getting a disease or any of that sort of thing is much cheaper on their system than having to treat a particular patient for whatever illness or injury that they may have. You guys are kind of the same way, because you understand that if you can just prevent an outage altogether, you're going to save yourselves a lot of money and a lot of heartache. The only difference is the hospital doesn't have to deal with storms that you don't have, they don't have any control over. And you guys really have to kind of juggle and balance both of those things.
Yeah. If not for the foul weather, it would be a much easier process.
Yeah. Blue sky days would happen more often.
Right. I think I mentioned in the last podcast that the cold and the heat don't necessarily impact us as much, because our engineering department is looking forecasting, where will we have problems in 5 or 10 years? And then proactively putting projects together to address that, maybe in the year or two before it becomes an issue. So
you're not just meteorologists, you're engineering forecasters, yes, as well.
We can predict where the growth will occur. You know where subdivisions and developments are coming in. It's a different game trying to predict where the storm's going to hit.
And if it's going to hit.
One season, last year, it seemed to hit the ridges west of Culpeper and then from Winchester down through Chester's Gap. Every storm seemed to hit that line.
That same path.
From Winchester down through western Culpeper. And then it shifts, and then it goes over and it hits Bowling Green,
mm-hmm,
in that area for a couple of months. So if you try to address pockets, sometimes you miss. That's why we look at these cyclic programs that address everything
and do that year round. So right, the odds then become more in your favor no matter where these storms come through.
Exactly. And one of the things we try to do is we're confident the outages will occur. We know we're going to have storms. I mentioned, I think earlier in this broadcast, that we have reliability and resiliency. Resiliency is the ability to recover after an outage has occurred. And we try to use our technology for some of that, where we can automatically restore systems or circuits. We will have technology that allows us to do that, where we can remotely control devices from our dispatch center. We have that in place.
Well, you mentioned earlier something about transferring loads to other places. So you can look and see, hey, this is in a place where the storm is probably going to come through, and control and redirect that power somewhere else so the people in that area may not lose power at all?
In some cases.
Wow.
It's after the fact, because you don't want to redirect it unless you have to. But in some cases, we call them back feeds or alternate circuit feeds, things of that nature. And they're not everywhere. A lot of our extremely rural areas, because the circuits are so long, you may have limited ability to do that. The urban areas, it's often more likely because you've got circuits that are packed in a little tighter. But it is absolutely one of the things that we consider. When we see a large outage, can we backfeed it? And if the answer is yes, then we proceed to do so. If we can't, then it's okay. Now, where do we go?
Crews on deck, and who's going to be where doing
right.
what?
And that brings me to another point. Our computer system will model where we think outages are based on the reports from our membership. So when a member calls in, it logs that call in the computer system and it says, okay, this member is out. And when the member first calls in, the system may say, okay, that person's transformer out on the pole or out in their front yard, that's what's out. Well, after that member's neighbors, 3 or 4 or 5 neighbors call in, the system's intelligence tells us, well, it's probably not 5 transformers in the same area that are out. It's probably the fuse that's feeding that whole area. And so the system will predict, based on the feedback, the calls from our members, where it thinks a device is open or where something is out.
So it's kind of like the AI we hear so much about in the news these days.
Yes.
You guys are actually using it to help predict some of that stuff as well.
Yes, and it helps speed restoration. Years ago, you would have one of the supervisors or managers that knew the system inside out, looking at the calls and going, okay, I think it's here. And now with our members' help calling in outages, now the system does it fairly accurately and quite quickly.
And I think we've had that conversation with Casey when she did a previous podcast, and even several times, I think, with Lewis. If you have a power outage at your home, don't assume your neighbor's going to call and you shouldn't. Go ahead and get on the app, use the smart hub, get on the app, use the phone. Actually let somebody at REC know that your power is out, because what if your neighbor is sitting in his living room thinking you're the one making the call and then nobody makes the call?
Right. Yeah, the calls definitely help our system predict. And I would also strongly advise our membership to take advantage of some of the technology that we have available for outage information.
Mm-hmm.
The texts, emails, your Facebook. We're very socially
yes.
active with our information. So definitely take advantage of that. We put it out there to try to make our members' tribulations with an outage a little more manageable. So hopefully they take advantage of that.
Oh, yeah, because your stress level goes through the roof, the roof the minute your power is out. But then it drops by probably 50 to 60% once you know either A, somebody's on scene, or B, they've already told you it'll be back in an hour, or it might be back in 4 or 5 hours. Just having that knowledge makes you feel less stressful, regardless of whether your power is back on yet or not, I think.
We don't like outages any more than our membership does, but we take it as a very serious part of our responsibility to minimize it and restore it as quickly as we can, as safely as we can.
So on that note, John, we're going to wrap up today's podcast. I have one last question that I want to ask you, and this is a question that sometimes people will have conversations and people will ask me about. If outages and trees and all of these things are such an issue, why not just put all of the power lines underground? I mean, I hear a lot about, I don't know why they just don't put all the power lines underground and then they won't have this issue with all these trees. That's not as easy as it sounds, I would assume, or else you guys would be doing it everywhere.
I think that question is asked after and during every storm event. And as a matter of fact, for those that listened in on the telephone town hall, that question was asked of Mr. Farmer. And I will parrot some of what he said. First and foremost, the cost is significantly higher than overhead. It sounds good initially until you realize that that cost would have to be borne by our members' rates.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission statement, connecting our members and communities with safe, reliable, affordable, and sustainable energy solutions. Putting everything underground would make that affordable portion extremely difficult. If you look at an underground circuit versus an overhead circuit, the cost could be between 4 to 10 times as much.
Wow.
Just because of the nature of the underground conductor versus the overhead conductor, the life expectancy of those facilities is about half.
Hmm.
What the overhead is. So not only is it going to cost you more up front to install it, but you're also going to have to be back in about
replacing it in half the time.
Right. About 30 to 40 years is the life expectancy for an underground primary line. The trouble is, after that line has been in the ground, you've typically got driveways and people's landscaping and front yards.
It's not as easy as pulling a truck up front and getting in a bucket truck and going up right. a pole. You've now got a whole new set of issues to deal yes. with to get that line.
So oftentimes the replacement cost is more than the install cost. And it's the inconvenience of the property owners because you're going to be in their yards, in their driveways, out in their road fronts. You can try to do directional boring, which is it's basically like a snake that goes underground. So you don't have to
tear everything up.
But that only gets you so much as far as the size of conductor and the numbers and things of that nature. The cable itself has to be larger. If you think about a light bulb out in open air, like a lamp, and how much heat that light bulb has around it. Heat is the enemy of our wire, of our mm-hmm. conductor. Take that same light bulb and put it inside a closed box and see what happens to the air around it. I think a lot of restaurants have heat lamps right over top of the
food for a reason. Yeah.
So the underground conductor, because it can't get rid of its heat as easily, it has to be larger wire to serve the same amount of load. So that drives the costs up additionally. Now, even though the costs are more upfront, there are a lot of situations where underground has kind of become the default. Your subdivisions, your lot plans, your large industrial parks and things of that nature have kind of defaulted to underground. If you look at our system, we have a little over 17,000 miles of line and almost 8,000 miles of that is underground. So we do have a lot of underground, but the heavier duty circuits and the major circuits, a lot of those are overhead. And it's because of these other reasons that we mentioned that that's the case. Maintenance is much easier on the overhead.
Oh, yeah.
To get to replace as necessary.
I will be your voice. I will go and tell everybody that I know, okay, the next time I hear this question, well, let me tell you why that isn't always the smartest thing. It looks good on paper, but sometimes not so much in practice, I guess, is probably a good way to start that answer.
Yeah, and there have been utilities that have looked at, you know, what would be the economic impact of converting everything overhead to underground, and it's astronomical. It's billions of dollars, regardless of what utility you're at, pretty much.
Yeah, it's not one of those things where you could, in good faith, say it would pay for itself in 5 or 10 years. It would pay for itself in 100 or 200 years,
if at all.
Okay, John, so I said I only had one more question, but then one of them popped up into my head as you were answering that one last question. So power blinks. I come home and the oven is blinking because the power has gone off for a split second during the day, or I'm at home in the evening and the lights will go on, the lights will go off over the course of a minute or two. Is that something I'm doing? Should I like panic that there's an electrical short in my house? Is that something on your end? What causes these momentary blinks of power?
So the momentary outages are a piece of equipment on our system that's operating to try to protect the system without causing an outage.
Ah.
So let me step back and talk about the breakers in your home. Okay, so you got the panel box or a fuse box down in your basement or out in the garage. And if something happens, if heaven forbid someone hedge clips their extension cord, it makes a big boom and it trips the breaker down in the basement or garage. So what's happening is we call it a fault. Other folks will call it a short circuit. Okay, so when a short circuit occurs in your home, or when a fault occurs in your home, that breaker is going to trip and turn off.
And it's a safety mechanism.
It's a safety mechanism. Exactly right. So our system has breakers and fuses, but one of the devices that we use a lot is called a recloser. And it's sort of like a smart breaker in your home. So what the recloser will do is, when it picks up a fault, when it senses a short circuit, is it will turn the circuit off briefly, typically for a couple of seconds. And the reason it's doing that is because studies have shown that a lot of faults are temporary. We talked about animals. You know, unfortunately, the animal goes up, it falls away from the line. Lightning strikes. You know, if a lightning strikes the line, it causes a flash, it causes a short circuit. So the recloser will turn the circuit off, and it'll wait anywhere from a couple seconds to maybe a half of a minute, and then it'll turn the circuit back on. And the reason it's doing that, again, is because a lot of faults are temporary in nature. And by turning the circuit off and waiting for a few minutes or a few seconds and turning it back on, it actually prevents a permanent outages or a sustained outage. Where we'll have to send a crew out to find what happened, replace a fuse, reset the device, something along those lines. So when you see the lights blink like that, it's actually the system protecting itself and preventing a long-term outage. I tell folks, start counting, and if you see three, most of our settings are after three blinks, it's done. So it'll try it two or three times, and then if it's still there, if the fault is still there, if the short circuit is still
yourself.
There, then it's going to be
get
out,
your phone
right?
and your smart hub app ready to report a power outage.
So when you see it start blinking, go for the flashlights and cross your fingers. If you get three, the fourth one it's going to be there for a while. So.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, because I always wondered, I just assumed it was something in my house, not necessarily something, you know, in the line. So that's good to know, too, because it kind of makes me feel a little bit more safe and comfortable knowing that you guys have those kinds of backups in place.
Yep.
Well, John, thanks for coming to hang out with me and having this really great, fascinating conversation. I appreciate the chat.
Oh, very welcome. Thank you for having me.